The John Murray Show on RTE Radio 1 with Kia Credit. Flexible 142 finance solutions from Kia, home of the 7-year warranty.
Now I'm joined by a man, a modern-day Shanachie, who found solace in his storytelling as he battled depression and alcoholism. His name is Neil Horgan, and here he is now, for starters, to perform an extract from his adaptation of Caoilte to the Swift.
The High King of Ireland was worried, for he had just lost his Royal Runner. Now, the Royal Runner was a most important post in ancient Ireland. It was his job to run around our island, search for footprints in the sand, invaders, Vikings, and run back to the king with the news. So with no Royal Runner, Ireland was vulnerable. But the High King decided to replace him, and he had a great competition, and hundreds of champions came. But he didn't just want any man. He wanted a man of the calibre of Finn McCool. Men who loved women and children and the earth. Men who could jump their own height. Men who could race through a forest without rustling a leaf or bending a twig. That's the type of man the High King required. Who would be our next Royal Runner? I was terrible at school. I was bottom of every class. But there was one day a year when I shone. That day was sports day, because I too was fast. And I remember my first sports day, 1975, aged 8. In my little white shorts, my white Airtex top, no shoes or socks, at the start of the 60-yard dash. And I ran 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 and I ran. And I came second, because bloody Dermot O'D was in my class. And in prep 2, age 9, another silver medal. In prep 3, age 10, another silver medal. And in prep 4, aged 11, you guessed it, silver again. And if you were to go to my bedroom back then, above my bed were 4 rusty nails with 4 silver medals, just below Debbie Harry, the Stranglers and Leeds United posters. And that voice never left my head. When will you ever come first? But 1979 rolled in. No more prep school and 60-yard dash. This was senior school and a 100-metre sprint. And I had a secret weapon. Blue and white Gola spikes. The best money could buy. And I prepared in the normal way. And a rumour went around the changing room. Dermot O'D is sick. Dermot O'D has the flu. Dermot O'D is sick, I thought. Dermot O'D has the flu. My chance. And as I walked to the line, the pressure was horrendous.
Yes, and you'll have to go to, we're teasing you a bit, but you'll have to go to Neil's show, Details to Come, to see how that race went. We're really teasing people this morning. And you're very welcome, Neil.
Thank you very much, John.
A very expressive performance, may I say. And how did you get into the storytelling thing? Was it just by accident or...?
Quite honestly, John, I was walking the Camino de Santiago last May, 40 days across Spain, and I met a lady from New Zealand, and she heard me telling my personal stories every day, and she said, you should go to the International School of Storytelling. And of course, I didn't believe there was such a place. And when I came back from Santiago, I Googled it. It exists, and impulsively, maybe crazily, I signed up to something I'd never seen or heard of myself.
And where is it?
It's in East Sussex in England. I call it Hogwarts for storytellers.
Right.
A mad place, but great.
And how did you get on?
They say I was top of my class. I was the only Irishman there. People from as far as New Zealand and Argentina. I was terrified. I had to go on stage. I had to perform. I'd never done that. I was a businessman. But people said I was good and I began to love it.
And how long did you spend there?
I was there nearly 4 months.
Right.
Living there and studying, and I hadn't been in school in a long time, as the story told this morning. And we were up at 8:30 every morning, singing nursery rhymes and getting into the creative space. And for an ex-managing director, that was a real challenge. It took me about 2 months to find my way, but it worked out.
And how did you support yourself throughout that period?
Well, I was very lucky to have help from my family and savings from my old life, which are whittled away now, but I was fortunate.
Well, we'll get back to the storytelling in a moment and what you've been doing with it since, but you mentioned telling the New Zealander and others on the Camino your personal story. Take us back.
Well, I suppose it starts in the 80s. Unfortunately, I was one of these guys who was too fond of the drink, and at 17 years of age, I found myself in a psychiatric hospital.
Where did you go to school?
Gonzaga College. I was expelled in fifth year, sadly, but I have good memories.
Why?
I don't think the Jesuits liked my black armband when Bobby Sands died. I don't think they liked my stash of adult literature they found one day. And they certainly didn't like me writing The Stranglers all over their property. So I was given a yellow and then finally a red in fifth year.
So you were a rebel?
I was a rebel, I suppose. So I was a troubled teenager. Mm. John, my parents split up when I was 12, and I found that very traumatic. I suppose I kind of got lost, and alcohol was a solution to how I felt about myself.
And when did you start drinking? What age were you?
I started drinking at the age of 12 and a half. And believe it or not, I had my first drink in the Pope's summer residence in Castle Gandolfo in 1980 with John Paul II. And little did I know what that drink was going to lead to.
And what was the drink?
Perno. Perno that some other youth from the Catholic Youth Council had smuggled into his back garden. And we thought we were great drinking in the Pope's summer residence while he was out talking to us, you know. I laugh at it now, but, you know, I didn't know what was to come.
And take us through then your time in secondary school. Were you constantly drinking then over the years?
Not constantly, you know. It started one day, turned to two, turned to three. But I was always in trouble with drink. I didn't drink like other people. I would black out. I would change personalities. But yet it was a surprise to end up in John of God's as a teenager. Mm. Diagnosed by Ryan Tuberty's father, Dr. Pat Tuberty, an alcoholic and a teenager and in school.
So how much were you drinking then? When it got to the stage when you were admitted to St. John of God's, what would you have been consuming?
I would have been drinking maybe 10 or 12 pints plus spirits, you know, which is a lot for a kid.
A day?
Four days a week, you know. I need 3 days off after that just to physically recover. You know, I was a young man, you know. You know our culture. It wasn't necessarily frowned on all the time to be drunk.
Mm. And you went into St. John of God's. But did that help?
Yes and no. Dr. Tuberty told me I'd be dead before I was 30 if I didn't stop, I should say. But I couldn't accept that I was an alcoholic and in school. It just didn't add up. I was to drink for another 10 years after coming out of John of God's.
Mm. But how did you fund all of that? How did you pay for it?
I stole. I broke into houses. I did non-Gonzaga College, South Dublin things, you know, but I was an addict.
Mm.
And I needed my fix, which was a legal drug.
And you went to UCD as well during this period?
I did. I somehow got into UCD, thanks to the matriculation in the old days. And I lasted a year and a half before I just dropped out. I was a mess. And I was surprised I actually lasted into second year in arts, but I did.
And you mentioned your parents, that they split up when you were 12. What did they make of your slide into alcoholism?
Well, they didn't. What do you do? The one thing we know about an alcoholic is that only they can help themselves. There was nothing my mother or father could have done to stop me drinking. It was only years later, when I decided I wanted to stop, that I got help.
Mm-hmm. But you kept on drinking until you were 29.
That's right.
So there's, what, about 12, 13 years of serious drinking?
Of serious functioning alcoholism, where I had a job and, you know, on the outside, probably looked okay, but you didn't see me passing out at night in front of the television and burning cigarettes in the carpet. You didn't see me throwing up in the shower in the morning. You know, I made sure of that. You saw my best side.
Because you began to work in the family firm.
I did. I was very lucky. Nobody was giving me a job in those days, and my dad gave me a job. And being a good businessman, he started me at the very bottom, postboy. Mm. And 20 years later, I was the managing director.
Yes, indeed. But that's something that you weren't able to deal with either really well. Sure you weren't. That you packed the drink in when you were 29, but you were to return to it then. How many years after that?
Sadly, I drank again after 14 years continuous sobriety. I would never have thought that would happen. But the pressure I was under in the job, plus a couple of other factors, like a relationship breaking up after 8 years, some childhood therapy that was obviously too extreme and fast and quick, and the recession came. And that tsunami toppled me over, John, and I broke down.
Because you were living the life, though, weren't you? You had a fancy car, you had a big salary with the company.
Mm-hmm. I was living the life. I was running marathons. I had the house on the hill. I had three Jaguars. And from the outside, you'd say, that fella has it all sorted. He's sober. But on the inside, I was breaking down. And I couldn't understand the polarity of my outside and my inside. And I tried and I tried and I tried to stay standing. But one day, I fell.
And tell us about that day.
If I'm brutally honest, I wanted to kill myself. I didn't have the courage. I went to a pub and I picked up a drink to give me the courage. And for 25 months after that, and this is not just me saying it, I don't really remember what happened, John. But I was in terrible pain and loneliness and anger and sadness. And I didn't think I'd make it through. I naturally resigned from the job. And if it wasn't for a trip to India, the Irish Sea every day for some relief, and slow, simple, gentle therapy, I wouldn't be with you today. And that's just being honest.
You mentioned anger. Where did the anger arise? And why did it arise?
It's funny, you know, Irish men aren't meant to be angry, you know. But I was carrying, you know, under anger is hurt, you know. That's what's underneath it. And I think under that is sadness. And the anger triggered the others. There was a part of me that felt sorry for myself in a strange way. I didn't want to be bipolar or alcoholic. And there was another part of me that was angry at myself for not living up to what I thought I should be. But it was very powerful, the anger, you know. And today I don't suppress my anger, I express it. And I was told that by suppressing my anger, I got depression. That's what anger unexpressed gave this human being.
And tell us about the depression.
The depression, it's hard to put words on. You're an empty shell. You hate yourself. You haven't much strength. But you're still alive. But you don't want to be. I just felt like the walking dead for a long time. And I have suffered depression all my life. And no doubt it will return. I'm not depressed today. But today I accept it. I don't try and change it. I don't medicate it. I go through it. And I was told, and this is really important, John, I was told that breakdown was something to be ashamed of. But I heard some people talk about breakdown, break out, break through, transform. No one had ever spoken that language around mental health. But it's true. You can look at a breakdown in a positive way. And I was so lucky that someone said that to me when I wanted to end my life, that this could be for a reason, because it doesn't feel like it's for a reason when it's happening. But looking back, my life has changed. You know, my life has changed because of a breakdown. But I was lucky to survive it. other people don't.
Now, what about your relationship with your parents and indeed the other members of the family?
Well, I suppose I'm the black sheep, you know, and not everyone has gone through my story. But, you know, my parents gave me everything. My sisters have always been there. They came in to visit me in John of God's all those years ago.
But how did they feel about you going back on the drink then after the gap of 14
years? They were terrified. Like me, they didn't see it coming. My psychiatrist didn't see it coming. My friends didn't see it coming. You know, it was like, oh, he might break down, but he won't drink. And maybe it was a cry for help. You know, maybe it was me pulling my life down. I don't know. But they were frightened. And I was lucky that I stopped for a second time, you know. And it was harder to get sober the second time, believe it or not.
And how bad did it get during those years?
I didn't drink for years on my relapse, far from it. But I remember one day being just sitting in my house, and the next moment I was fighting American tourists on Baggot Street Bridge. And I'm going, what happened? And the answer was, I took a drink. That's what happened. I don't know what, you know, I can't explain that. But to me, that's alcoholism, when you just lose complete control of who you want to be. I don't want to be fighting tourists on Baggot Street Bridge. I wasn't brought up to do that. But that's what alcohol does to this human being.
Mm-hmm. So at the age of 43, you packed it in for the second time. Mm-hmm. And what succeeded in that year of your life that hadn't previously? Like, what happened on that day? Did you wake up saying, that's enough of that now?
Yeah, I mean, well, for starters, it doesn't work for people like me. And I decided that I was going to give life one more try, and I was really going to change. And I wasn't just going to stop drinking. I was going to change how I related with my family, my friends, my career, my health, my everything. I was going to just start again. And that was terrifying, John. Terrifying, because I was my job. You know, I liked being a managing director. People said, you're great. And then one day it was gone. The relationship was gone. My sobriety was gone. My job was gone. And they were lonely times.
Mm. What age are you now, Neil?
47.
So 4 years without drink.
4 years, one day at a time.
And how tough has that been?
It's okay. It's okay. I have a wealth of experience. I know what it's like to not drink for a long, long time. And I'm back in that. Happy to not be drinking, and I'm more concentrating on keeping depression at bay these days.
And do you have to take active steps every day to do that?
Yes, I do. Yes,
and what
I
do you do?
My little program is I talk about how I feel, which is rare with Irish men sometimes. I jump in the Irish Sea, even yesterday with all the jellyfish. I go for a walk, and I do some storytelling. If it's to myself. But normally a few people are listening, John, you know. Mm. And that's my little program of mental health recovery. That works for me. It mightn't work for anyone else.
Does it mean you have to avoid certain situations?
Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, yeah. I avoid stress, you know, as much as anyone can. You know, I won't sign up to something that I know could threaten my stability internally. I try and live a simple life, something that I would have thought was boring. In the past.
And what about a livelihood, making ends meet?
Well, I'm trying to be Ireland's first economically viable storyteller. So please come to my show next Thursday.
Yes, yeah, because you take this is what you've dedicated the last couple of years to developing your skills as
yes,
a storyteller.
I had a moment, finish on this. I had a moment in the Himalayas last winter. Where I was telling a story to 12 people around a fire, way up high. And I was crying, and some of them were crying. And I just had a moment of clarity where I knew this is what I have to do.
And why were you crying?
Because I was happy. Because I'd finally found something that made sense, that felt right, and that I thought I was, this is me. This is really me. It's crazy. I'm in the Himalayas. I'm telling stories. Who would have thought it? Mm. And I'm trying to hold on to that feeling of having a purpose and a meaning and doing something you love.
And do you weave your personal stories into your storytelling? Is it part of the act?
Yes, the show, which runs for 6 weeks, will have biographical storytelling every Thursday at lunchtime and old tales, and I weave them together. Mm. And people seem to like when the storyteller becomes the story.
Mm. And you, obviously then you get feedback from other people who might be in a similar predicament.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm not afraid to deal with issues like rejection and addiction and money and greed. I tell stories about these things because that's who I am. Mm. You know, I've done these things. Mm. And it's rare these days that someone gets up and just shows themselves and just says, you know, all isn't well. Mm. I wasn't a great person. But people seem to connect with that.
But you're a happier camper now.
I'm a happier camper now, John, one day at a time.
And what about those who might be facing into similar struggles? What would you say to them?
Well, addiction is curable one day at a time. There's plenty of help out there. Depression is a little different. I think that's a long journey. But there is oodles of help in 2014 that wasn't there in the 70s and 80s when I first went looking for help. Mm. But the most important thing is to ask for help. That's hard.
Mm. And your family today, how are they all? How are relations with them all?
Good, 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 good. My sister has asked me to tell a story at her wedding in Mead in September. Okay. So I'm nervous. That's a tough audience.
That'll be an uplifting story, surely.
Yes, she's asked for no depression. She doesn't want anything about addiction. No. So I'm going to tell her a lovely story about Mother Earth.
Right. Well, it sounds to me that you have a bit of a gift with the storytelling, and thank you for coming in and telling your story this morning, Neil. And just a reminder, Neil, with his stories, the traditional stories mixed with his own life stories, can be heard at the Powers Court Town House Centre Theatre every Thursday at 1 o'clock from July 31st to mid-September.
Next Thursday, 1 o'clock. Come along and have some entertainment during your lunch, all you city centre workers.
Great. Neil Horgan, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, John.
On foot of our discussion earlier with Neil Horgan, if you want to talk to someone, you can contact the Samaritans at 116123. That's from the Republic of Ireland and is a free phone number. And Pieta House is 016235606. AT in Dublin says, your guest, Neil Horgan, is so honest and succinct. He speaks so truly that depression is repressed anger and under it is distress and sadness. Psychotherapy and counselling is so important.